Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Have you ever wondered about which movie had the more intense opening? Face Off or Finding Nemo? Or what movie villain would you hang out with? If you have, then you're probably Shay Serrano. And if you are, thanks for listening, Shay. Shay is a staff writer for the sports and pop culture website, The Ringer. He's also the author of Movies and Other Things, a collection of questions asked, answered, illustrated. It features a series of fun, innovative cinematic thought experiments, like would adding action superstar The Rock to a movie make it better or worse?
The intention here is you're going to take a very silly thing extremely seriously, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, we're talking about The Rock.
Mm-hmm.
We're just putting The Rock in the new movies. But it doesn't work if you're just doing it with no, like, underlying intention, no real reason. And in this case, what this chapter, what this very silly chapter is supposed to do once you get past the veneer of it, is it's supposed to be some sort of commentary on The Rock creating for himself a sort of global stardom that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
He was able to do it now when it just doesn't happen. It's not like in the 90s when Tom Hanks does a movie and then all of a sudden he's the biggest star in the world. It doesn't work like that right now. Everything's so fractured and segmented. But The Rock was able to do it. He was able to achieve that. And the way that he was able to do it is he just decided, you know what? I'm going to be in every single thing.
Yeah.
Everything you can think of, I'm going to be in it. So from 2016 to 2018, he's in 7 different movies
over
that period.
Yeah.
And so the idea here is like he became a star. How did he do it? Okay, he did it this way. All right, cool. Let's sort of talk about that. And the way we're going to talk about it without talking about it is we're just going to put him in even more movies. We're going to go backwards, and we're going to put him in Titanic, and we're going to put him in P.S. I Love You, and we're going to put him in Predator, and we're going to put him in My Girl. And like, all right, well, like, if you're doing that, like, why are we doing it? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll figure out if it's a better same or worse with him in there.
Yeah, and you mentioned Titanic, which, of course, was directed by my fellow Canadian James Cameron. It's the 1997 blockbuster. So I'm guessing in this film that The Rock replaces Leonardo DiCaprio, correct?
That would be incorrect. In this case, we're replacing Rose. And in our new scenario, with The Rock as Rose, everything still happens exactly the same. The ship hits the iceberg, it goes down, but nobody dies because all of the passengers simply climb onto The Rock's back and he swims the rest of the way and everybody's safe.
Yeah.
And Rose is just so far from what The Rock is, like, ostensibly.
Right.
And you look at The Rock and he's like this giant, handsome, muscle man. Is like the opposite of what Rose's character is in the movie, which is this sort of debutante. We'll do that. It'll just be more fun.
Right. So does this casting change make Titanic better, worse, or same?
It makes it so much better.
Yeah.
Because nobody dies.
Yeah, but, exactly. It's got an uplifting, happy ending. It's not a tragedy anymore.
Now it's a great story.
Yeah, yeah. I know it's a lot, the hair, the bod. When you're staring at a demigod, what can I say except you're welcome for the time. You also created a gangster movie moment fictional draft, which serves as a ranking of your top 30 scenes from gangster films. What were the criteria you used to come up with your favorites?
Well, whenever you have a big conversation like this, you have to do some fence building here. Otherwise, everything's going to get away from you. So, for example, one of the rules that we set up ahead of time was, all right, you can only use the same movie twice. You can only, if you're going to pick a scene from a movie, you can't use that movie more than twice. And the reason we put this rule in place is because otherwise you're going to have 10 scenes from Goodfellas in the draft.
Yes.
And you don't want that.
No.
You know. Another one, the most controversial rule in this situation was Robert De Niro is the greatest gangster movie actor that's ever been. You put him in a gangster movie, it's immediately better. He's just perfect in that capacity. So he's been in so many of them. He did Goodfellas and Casino and Once Upon a Time in America and The Untouchable. Like, there's a Bronx Tale. He's the guy.
Yeah.
And so even if you still have the rule in place where you can only use 2 scenes from a movie, you can still end up with like a very heavy De Niro draft.
Yeah.
because how can you not have the baseball bat scene from The Untouchables?
Sunny day, stands are full of fans. What does he have to say? I'm going out there for myself. But I get nowhere unless the team wins.
Team.
The rule here is, much like when they made NBA Jam and Michael Jordan was not in it,
yeah,
in our draft, you can't pick any scene where De Niro is the main character.
That's great. Yeah. So was there one pick that you think is kind of like, because you did the top 30, right? The top 30 scenes or moments from gangster movies. Is there one that you think it was your best pick and was kind of sort of off the grid and that something would be a little, people would be surprised by?
Well, yeah, I think we ended this one. The number one pick in this situation was we did a scene from a movie called The Bronx Tale.
Now you just can't leave.
I will never forget the look on their faces. All 8 of them. Their faces dropped. All their courage and strength was drained right from their bodies.
Bronx Tale is an underappreciated movie. It's lower stakes. It doesn't have this sort of world-chasing ambition that something like a Scarface does. It doesn't try to explain all of everything of, like, mafia life like The Godfather did. It just focuses in on one neighborhood and one group of people, and that was the scene there. And this is probably my favorite gangster movie. Which is why I wrote the thing. I wanted to write about this one specific scene.
Yeah, it's also a very personal film to you, A Bronx Tale, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I watch it and I see a little bit of myself in there. I mean, there's some similarities to my life. Like, for example, the main character is a young kid named C. Mm-hmm. He grows up in this neighborhood, and on one side he's got Sonny, the like main gangster, trying to pull him in one direction, and then on the other side he's got his father, played by Robert De Niro, of course.
Mm-hmm.
He plays like this noble bus driver trying to pull him in the other direction, and those are like the, you know, all of the movie's main themes are presented through these two characters. One guy's telling him one thing, the other guy's telling him another thing. And one guy's telling him, you know, Mickey Mantle's not going to pay your rent. Why do you care about Mickey Mantle? The other guy is like going through baseball stats with him in this very earnest and sincere way. Not because of baseball is so important, but because he sees it as a way to, like, connect with his son.
Where's my money, Dad?
I left it in there.
What? How could you do that, Dad? It was my money.
That's bad money. I don't want you to have that money.
Dad, I earned that money.
I said I want you to stay away from him.
Dad, please listen to me.
I said you stay away from him.
Dad, listen to me!
Did you hear what I said? You stay away from him!
Sonny was right. The Wilker man is a sucker, Dad. He's a sucker.
He's wrong. It don't take much strength to pull a trigger, but try and get up every morning, day after day, and work for a living. Let's see him try that. Then we'll see who's the real tough guy. The working man is the tough guy. Your father's the tough guy.
But everybody loves him, just like everybody loves you on the bus. It's the same thing.
No, it's not the same. People don't love him. They fear him.
I have a very similar relationship with my father. Also, he's a bus driver. He's been doing it for 30 plus years in San Antonio, and it's just like, oh, these pieces sort of fit here. It touches me.
One of the most comprehensive things that you do in your book is to go through almost 25 years of movie history to reshuffle the Academy Awards and create what you call the brand new Academy Awards. You take some Oscars away from people and then give them to people who you think are more deserving recipients. Mm-hmm. What was your biggest takeaway from this experience?
My biggest takeaway from this experience is that the Oscars gets a lot of stuff wrong. Mm-hmm. I didn't start paying attention to the Oscars until like 2 or 3 years ago, really.
Yeah.
Like 1999 is one of the biggest years in cinema history, one of the most like influential and impactful. There's a great number of incredible movies that came out that year. So for the Academy Awards, you look at who won for them and you're like, what the heck was happening? Why did you not pick these other movies that, you know, 20 years later, it's so easy to see how important this movie was. So my main takeaway was that, like, even the people who are supposed to know more than everybody else screw up a whole bunch of times.
Yeah, it makes me think, 20 years later, maybe we need to incorporate time travel into the Oscars. Maybe we, you know what I mean, need to go 20 years in the future and then award films from like 1999.
So this guy Bill Simmons, who I've worked for several years, he's great in these sorts of spaces, and he had this wonderful idea of we should give out the Oscars like several years after the fact.
Yes.
We're not
going
to do it right
exactly.
Then. We can wait a little while. And that's a
great idea. What was the what was the easiest decision to make in terms of the brand new Academy Award? What was the easiest one to decide, oh, I'm taking this person doesn't deserve it and this person really does deserve it? Can you point to one example?
Yeah. A recent one is Green Book winning for Best Picture, mm-hmm. which is like, whoops,
yeah.
that should not have happened. that was one when they made that decision, everybody sort of in real time understood this was the wrong decision to make. The first line everybody drew was like, oh, this is Crash all over again, Crash winning for Best Picture. So something like that. Or Get Out, which I think is the like most important, most insightful movie that's been made over the last few years, not winning Best Picture. Like that's the first one I think of when Oscar tragedies that should be fixed immediately. That should be the one.
What is it that's so special about Get Out?
Get Out is one of those movies where you watch it and it's number one, it's just an incredibly made movie. It's well written, mm-hmm. it's well directed, it's well acted. There's not a part in there where you go like, oh, this movie would have been 5% better if they'd have done this other way.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also, this is very much talking about like the way America is working currently or has worked for the past however many years. And if you can make a movie that entertains you on like a number of different levels without really compromising any of the stuff it's trying to do, you should celebrate something like that. And Get Out, it was just so obvious from the moment it came out.
And I start putting
that it was
together.
Perfect.
And see, this is what I came up with. They're probably abducting black people, brainwashing them, and making them slaves or sex slaves, not just regular slaves. But all I know is they already got two brothers we know, and it could be a whole bunch of brothers they got already. What's the next move?
And don't ever, ever say that I don't do nothing for you. Old white girl. Oh, they get you every time.
This was like a Shawshank in 1995. Like, oh, wow. Nobody saw this at the theater, and it had a big second life later on. But at the time, we sort of missed it. It's the same thing with Get Out. Like, we celebrated it a little bit, but not enough.
Yeah. Speaking of Shawshank, the Shawshank Redemption, you have a whole chapter about this, which you say that one of your favorite things to consider when you watch a movie is when there's a moment that you know happened in the film, but it happened off screen. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah. This was an idea that I had a while back. I was rewatching this TV show called The Office. Are you familiar with The Office?
Yes, I am.
So at the end of season two, Pam and Jim, sort of lovers circling each other, but not really, they share a kiss. Jim mm-hmm. finally works up the nerve to kiss Pam. And that's the end of the season. And she's like, oh, you know, I can't do this. I'm going to marry this other guy. And then there you go. It's done. And I very much wanted to know what that next day at work looked like.
Mm.
Did Jim show up to work? Did he take a couple of days off? There was certainly some weirdness there. What was the first thing Pam said to him when they finally did talk? Like, I wanted to know about that. And that was the genesis of the idea. The same thing works here in movies. In Shawshank, for example, the warden arranges for like his main tough guy guard to shoot and kill another a prisoner, mm-hmm. a guy who like threatens whatever.
Yeah.
And so at some point, the warden had to have approached the guard, Hadley, and explained to him what he wanted him to do. And I would like to know like how that went. Was the guard just like, all right, cool? Did the warden have to lean on him a little bit? What was the interplay here? I like to think about stuff that we know for certain happened in a movie. It's fun to imagine those scenes.
Yeah, and we just don't know how they happen. So yeah, that's great. I've got to start doing that more. In fact, I don't know if I've been doing it at all, but I'll have to go to school on what you're doing because it is such a great concept. Yeah, you also explore the concept of hanging out with a movie villain. Which mm-hmm. heavy would you most like to hang out with?
Oof, that depends on like what I'm trying to accomplish. But mm-hmm. if we're just talking about interesting people who I wouldn't mind being around.
Yeah,
I would like to hang out with Hannibal Lecter.
In fact, I found a very nice rendering of it here in the library the other day. If you like, perhaps I could sneak it out for you.
I would think that might jeopardize your chances for permanent appointment to the curatorship.
Only if you told.
I'm going to learn a bunch of stuff that I didn't know. He's going to teach me about some opera and some wine and, like, the way to cook a kind of meat. Like,
yeah.
Because a guy explains it. Barney explains it in the movie Hannibal when the new Clarice character asks him, how did you survive around him all of these years? It wasn't just by being polite. And he's like, yes, that's exactly what it was. Oh. I just wasn't rude. He hates rude people.
Okay, yeah.
All right, I can be polite.
Sure, just be on your best behavior, yeah. Mm-hmm. We were wondering if you were a movie villain, what kind of a movie villain you would be. Perhaps you have a little bit of Patrick Bateman in you, a hint of Tyler Durden, maybe some Freddy Krueger. What do you think?
No, so this is the thing. When you have a movie villain, mm-hmm. a movie villain implicitly is cool. They're yeah. doing cool things. They're saying cool things.
And you're not and cool?
I have never been that in my life. Nobody has ever been like, man, Shay is cool. Everybody has been like, man, Shay is kind of funny sometimes. But nobody has been like, man, you know who he reminds me of? Tyler Durden from Fight Club. I'm not that at all. I'm like, best case scenario in that situation, I'm Robert Paulson. I'm a Meatloaf's character. Like I like want to hang out and I want to be involved, but like things are gonna go wrong for me every time.
I think I don't know you well. Obviously, I haven't had the chance to hang out with you, but I, based on what you write, your work, and just talking to you, you seem very cool.
Oh, the work, sure, the work is cool, but like in person, we're not gonna be doing some cool stuff. We're gonna be doing some very generic things.
Okay, so you have a very cinematic name, Shay Serrano. Would you keep that name if you were a movie villain, or would you go for something else, maybe like Shay Soze, Kaiser Serrano, or Ferris Durden, or something like that? What do you think?
Yeah, you need a harder last name for me. Mm. Like you need a good, like I have two R's in my name, but yeah. I think you need like an R at the end of the name. The R is the most threatening letter. Mm. So I need that in there.
Shay Serranor? Serranor?
Like yeah, that? See, it just got worse. Got worse.
Yeah. You write a bit about the 1997 biopic, Selena, in which Jennifer Lopez plays the music star Selena Quintanilla Perez. As mm-hmm. a Mexican-American, is there any scene in this film that kind of captures your life experience?
There's one that does exactly that, and it's the whole reason they put it in there, and it's the whole reason, not necessarily that this movie exists, but it's the whole reason that the movie feels the way that it does. And in this scene, Edward James Olmos is riding in the car. He plays Selena's father, and he's riding in the car in a van with Selena and with her brother. Selena's played by Jennifer Lopez. The brother is played by Jacob Vargas. And the brother and sister, they're trying to get the dad to like book them a gig in Mexico because the opportunity has come up. And he's like, well, this might not work out that great for you. And they're trying to figure out why, and he gets into this whole conversation about like being Mexican is different than being Mexican American. Being Mexican American means like you're caught in the middle.
Their homeland is on the other side of the ocean. Ours is right next door, right over there. And we gotta prove to the Mexicans how Mexican we are, and we gotta prove to the Americans how American we are. We gotta be more Mexican than the Mexicans and more American than the Americans, both at the same time. It's exhausting. Man. Nobody knows how tough it is to be a Mexican-American.
It's the best examination of the idea that has happened in a movie up to that point and since then. And we're talking, you know, over 20 years already. I don't think there's a better way to do it than the way that they did it, those three right there. Because you've got him, and he's being very serious and earnest in explaining this thing to them. Meanwhile, Jennifer Lopez and Jacob Vargas are, like, in a very, like, daughter-son sort of way, poking jokes at him and making fun of him. And he's trying to, like, impart some real knowledge, and they're not ready to hear it yet. And it's all of the parts here are wonderful.
Shay Serrano, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, man. It's always fun.
Shay Serrano is a staff writer for The Ringer and the author of Movies and Other Things, a collection of questions asked, answered, illustrated, featuring art by Arturo Torres. Find out more about Shay and the weird questions he asks himself about movies at wpr.org/beta.
I am not as disciplined as Abishalai is. I'd say that's the biggest difference. She's also a bit more traditional than I am.
Actor Folake Olowofoyeku talks about the differences between her and the character she plays on the sitcom Bob Hart's Abishola. That's coming up on Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.